The following Noble Path Talk is part of an informal series offered to Sangha members for those who've been practicing at the Zen Center of New York City, Fire Lotus Temple. Each Sangha member shares their experience of how they came to find the Dharma and how their practice has been developing. We hope you enjoy the diversity of voices and experiences. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, everyone. I love that radiant to the heart part. We say it a lot, but it feels like, yeah, I really want to be radiant. I don't know if I will be, but that's a great goal. So I saw a lot of people headed up to beginning instruction. So I'm feeling like there's quite a few new people. So welcome if you're new. Welcome back if you're not. As Tenfu said, my Dharma name is Joshin. My pronouns are she and her. And I've been practicing with the MRO, the Mountains and Rivers Order, for about 20 years. My teacher is Shugen Roshi, and he lives up at the monastery up in Mount Tremper. So I want to talk today about our bodies. And when I say our, I usually mean mine, because I have to speak from my experience, and I'm hoping that you'll find things that resonate with you about your bodies, too, or bodies that are supposed to be formless and empty in Zazen, but feel very formed. Our bodies feel like a constant question to me. They're kind of mysterious. I don't really know how they work. And they contain paradoxes. The Dharma teaches us that we are beyond distinctions, that we contain everything. And when we chanted the Heart Sutra this morning, we chanted that form is no other than emptiness, and emptiness no other than form. So everything falls away in the Buddha Dharma. And the Buddha Dharma is right now in our bodies. That's why there's so many negations in the Heart Sutra. We have this no consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. Everything falls away so that everything can exist. But this isn't always true for me. When I was younger in my family, my body was kind of problematized as I was growing up. My parents are from Puerto Rico, and the island is home to a full range of bodies of varying colors. But like in many places, there's a hierarchy of color, with the lightest skinned folks, people who considered themselves white, who are at the top. And so goes the island, so went my home. So since I'm the darkest member of my family, I was considered odd and a bit of a problem. I was also thin. And for my family, that was also a problem because I was considered sickly, even though I wasn't. But it was just this island, I guess, idea about what a healthy, acceptable body looks like. So in the midst of this body and this conditioning and all sorts of karma, just like you, with your own, I sit Zazen. And I come to this temple and I'm asked and encouraged to let my body and mind fall away, to recognize essentially the unreality of them. This isn't so easy. So the Heart Sutra that I just mentioned, it takes the form, as probably many of you already know, as a teaching by the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara to the Arahant Shariputra. And Avalokiteshvara is the Bodhisattva of compassion who listens to the cries of the world and alleviates our suffering by pointing out to us what the nature of reality is. And I'm not going to go into the Heart Sutra. I just want to highlight Shariputra for a minute. He's being addressed by Avalokiteshvara because he is the chief disciple, the first chief disciple of the Buddha, what we call our shuso. And he kind of stands in for all those, not just in, I was going to say in first century India, but not just in first century India. He stands in for all of those right now, today, who are more concerned with the attainment of knowledge than the attainment of wisdom. And Avalokiteshvara calls him out into saying that the teaching is more subtle than you think. And in fact, you can't think your way to it. You must experience this world and these teachings through other means. And one way is through our bodies. So although Shariputra was considered the wisest of the disciples, his understanding wasn't complete. And we have a story from the Vimalakirti Sutra where Shariputra is called out on his misunderstanding of the body or form. So in the story, a goddess meets Shariputra at Vimalakirti's home. And Vimalakirti was a lay practitioner who was very realized. A lot of people, gods, goddesses, arahants, are all at Vimalakirti's home. And Shariputra is speaking to this goddess. And he's really impressed by her wisdom and asks, since you're a goddess, wouldn't it be better if you transformed yourself into a male body? And the implication being that, well, all sorts of implications, right? That maybe she'd be enlightened if she had a male body. Maybe life would be easier for her if she had a male body. So the goddess changed Shariputra into her form and changed herself into his and then asked him, why don't you transform yourself out of your female state? And Shariputra is shocked, and so I'm just going to read a piece of it here to you. So and he cries out, I no longer appear in the form of a male. My body has changed into a woman's body. I don't know what to transform. And she replied, just as you are not really a woman, but appear to be female in form, all women appear to be female in form, but are not really women. Therefore, Buddha said that all beings are not really men or women. Then she changed Shariputra back into his own form and asked, and where is your female form now? Where is your female form now? So Shariputra was clearly voicing the words of prejudice and bias and tells us that even an arahant held views and made distinctions and makes them today. It sounds like an ancient story, but it's a story of today. And it's a story of me. I have views. I make distinctions. And I'll be honest, I kind of like my female body. And I can actually get even a little snobbish about it. Like, I'm a woman, yay. Again, attitude. I know in my head that there's no distinction to be made here. And that truly, we are all bodies of illumination. But I'm kind of like Shariputra. Like, I don't know it. I know with my mind, and maybe sometimes even more than my mind, that we aren't distinct from each other, not at that bone, carbon, stardust level. Hojin talked about it a couple of weeks ago. I love that stardust level, right? That we contain all things. And that with Walt Whitman, who says he contains multitudes, we also contain each other. And in Zazen, I get a taste of that, right? My body and my mind fall away. Our thinking minds finally come to rest. No distinctions, no grasping. And we enter the space of ease. We had a teacher here in the MRO named Zuisei, and she said, in Zazen, my mind can finally rest. And I say that to myself sometimes when I'm coming to sit and my mind is in turmoil or I don't really want to sit. I just say, come, rest, mind. Just rest. You've been too busy. And that kind of works. I feel like, yeah, respite. I need that. When we let the thoughts drop away, the Zen teacher Koshi Ukiyama says that we are opening the hand of thought and we are truly letting body and mind fall away. when such a falling away occurs, we can be the multitude of things. And maybe even more incredibly, each moment becomes eternity. We have upended the aspects of time we usually struggle with. But when we're off the cushion, in the relative world, our bodies are at the forefront of what sometimes feels like an aggressive world. And sometimes I'm the aggressor. I can be arrogant about my body. I take it for granted because I haven't had major physical limitations to deal with yet. I see myself walking past older people or anyone who's slower than I am, which is a lot of people because I really have become a kind of a fast walker. And I'm kind of weaving through, just kind of doing this bob and weave that we do in New York City. And I have made people feel bad. Recently, there was an older woman ahead of me. And I do what I always do. I start to like see where the spaces are. Where can I, how can I pass her? How slow was she going? And she felt me behind her. And she stopped. And she said, just go on ahead. And I felt so bad. And that's not the only person. There's like parents pushing strollers and they feel me coming and they stop and they kind of apologize a little bit. And they're just, go ahead, go around me. And I'm like, okay, thank you. See ya. I got things to do. I can't walk that slow. I'm making people feel bad. And that's not hard to do in New York City where everything feels like it's about pacing and moving and changing and becoming. We're just always on it. It's not about disintegrating or decaying or unbecoming. No falling apart. That's not allowed. In fact, when we see that, we're like, don't get too close. I don't want to catch that. Keep that unbecoming falling apart to yourself a little bit. When we're falling apart, we end up making excuses for it. Justifications, as if we need to justify that being human. This doesn't work. It doesn't work for many of us. And for those of us who it works for right now, it won't work for us forever. But I took my body as a kind of standard, thinking this is the way bodies work, right? And as a danger. Obviously, in thinking that you're a standard. We often don't realize the many ways we believe we're the norm, or the many times we think that things are going to stay relatively the same. Even when we know they won't, we really don't know they won't. There's arrogance here too. That's why Shariputra was caught voicing his prejudice against the female form. He knew that form is emptiness, but he didn't really know it. He forgot. And he had the good fortune of a generous goddess to remind him. Because as Shariputra goes, so goes the world. In the Christian Bible, there's a story where Jesus played the role of that goddess to a group of men who wanted to stone a woman who had committed adultery. They said that the laws allow them to stone her, and they asked Jesus, "What do you say?" So Jesus says, let anyone among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her. So of course, they were honest with themselves. They're like, okay, we all sin. We have to go. So Jesus' response, though, was an undoing of the delusion that held that crowd together, just as Shariputra was undone by the goddess. In thinking about this story, the poet and essayist Padraic O'Tooma said this: the woman was about to be stoned because of the addictions of the stoners. They were addicted to a violent kind of belonging, a kind of community that forges its borders through selective exclusion. She was about to be stoned with their bone-breaking morals that would prefer to kill a woman rather than examine their own complicity. We all need to be rescued from this kind of power, from both its appeal and its effect. An undoing of this power is seen when power is used for love. the questions, the bone-breaking morals, the learning that is life, all of this is our inheritance as human beings. That appeal of abusive power and the rescue from that appeal. We all need rescuing. The Dharma helps us. A Sangha helps us. So those of us who have been involved with this order for a while, this practice for a while, know that we're about a month into our full Angha, our 90-day intensive training period. And one of the texts that we're working with is from Dogen Zenji. So I love that it's his Memorial Day today, because I'm going to read a little chunk of it. And it's I think it's just so beautiful. It's from Arousing the Aspiration for Enlightenment. So first I'm going to read it to you. It feels almost like a poem to me. This aspiration for enlightenment is not self, not other, and does not come from somewhere else. However, after arousing this aspiration, when taking up the great earth, all of it turns into gold. When stirring the great ocean, it immediately turns into nectar. After arousing this aspiration, if you hold mud, stones, or pebbles, they also take up the aspiration for enlightenment. If you practice splashes of water, bubbles, or flames, they intimately bring forth the aspiration for enlightenment. Thus, the offering of land, castles, spouses, children, men and women, the seven treasures, heads, eyes, marrow, brains, bodies, flesh, and limbs is crowded with arousing of aspiration for enlightenment, the vital activity of the aspiration for enlightenment. I love this part. I love that whole head, eyes, marrow, everything filled with this vital activity of aspiring for enlightenment. It kind of makes me excited because it's so rich and so earthy and so much in my bodies. And sometimes when we talk about Zazen, it feels very heady and abstract. But when Dogen is speaking about the marrow full of aspiration, that's something I get. I feel like that's me, right? My best days, that's me. Because it also has like this language of a quest to it. And I like quests. I love that question begins with quest. I love that. I love all of that stuff. And I used to think that questions went only to my mind, but I've come to realize through the practice of Zazen, really, that questions are full-bodied the way a quest is. You got to be completely in it, body and mind, if you want to live into the answers, which I don't even really know if there's such a thing as answers anymore. Becoming more of a process person. Just life seems very complicated for just simple answers. And I got this idea about living into questions from the poet, Rainer Maria Rilke. You may know this quote already. So it's clear, by the way, by now that I didn't come up here by myself. So far, I've had Shariputra and Dogen and Rilke is coming, so many others. I'm wearing Tenfu's Rakusu, so there's like a crowd. There's a crowd here with me. So here's what he says. Be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves, like the locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue. Do not seek the answers which cannot be given you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. Isn't that good? So I think about these answers or resolutions are just temporary. Life will change us. Life changes. What seemed like an answer may have just been a little bit of a prerequisite for the next part. Feels like we are provisional. August Rodin was a mentor to Rilke, the sculptor August Rodin. And when Rodin was, when Rilke was stuck in a decade-long writer's block, unable to write, but still calling himself and believing he was a poet. He says, I'm a poet. I just can't write. He says, change. Rodin told him, change. Be the change. And we cannot sit still. We know that from Zazen, in good ways and in bad ways. Sometimes it feels like we just can't keep still. And sometimes we're still. And it's still so dynamic. It's still so alive, right? You're not falling asleep. You're just there. And it feels like all of life is coursing through. It feels so, alive, I guess, that I could, it feels like I want to dance. I don't know if you've had like a week of session, like an intensive week of sitting. That's the first thing I want to do. Like I want to dance, right? Wisdom. So what are the questions I'm living in now? So many, but here's something that arose kind of as a question. We'll see what you make of it. So my husband is Black, and he has been dealing with this idea of there being standard bodies all his life. His body is not considered the standard in many white circles in which he deals with and moves through. And as I move along with him, I notice the many ways that white body people react to him. And so one of the more interesting reactions came while we were on vacation in the Finger Lakes area, way upstate. This happened in August. It's a beautiful area, waterfalls, hills, wineries. Just if you drive in New York, you'd appreciate that the roads are really smooth. And my husband is a really gregarious person. Those of you who know him know he could talk to like a brick wall for half an hour before he notices no one's responding. He makes friends wherever he goes. If you were to walk down the street with him in Brooklyn, people would stop and know him. Just know him. Manhattan, everywhere we go, it's always the same. And so we're in this little, there's a little group of white people walking on this waterfall trail with us. And my husband, of course, is talking to the older man. My husband's name is Bobby. He's talking to the older man for a bit. And then we all go our separate paths. And then later in the day, we're at this winery. And that group is there too. And the older man comes up to me and Bobby. And he looks at Bobby and he reintroduces himself. And of course, we know who he is. And he asks whether he can take a picture of Bobby. And Bobby's smiling. He says, sure. But I kind of intervene. And I just start talking to the man about what they're doing for the day and what we're doing. And I've decided that this man is not going to take a picture of Bobby. Like, that isn't happening. It's weird. I don't want a stranger taking a picture of him. And I felt very New York City protective. But I also felt this man's longing. He's living deep in white America, and he's met this nice Black man that he's just hit it off with, and he's having this special moment. This is not every day for him. Maybe he's been longing for this connection. Maybe he's been longing for this moment. Maybe it's never going to happen again. But I'm not going to let this picture happen. I've already decided that. And it doesn't. I've pulled the conversation in a different place. And I felt like a little annoyed, and I felt a little bit sad, but mostly I just felt self-satisfied. I was kind of like, that has been thwarted. My sweet man, my sweet Black man has not been taken a picture of by a sweet white man. That's, you know, my agenda has been met. And when I talked about this with Bobby later, he didn't make nearly as big a deal of it, of course, as I did, because he's been in his body for 70 years. And actually, he was just pretty happy with the vibes that we got in the Finger Lakes area, because upstate New York can be hostile to people of color, and particularly to dark-skinned Black men. And we've had that experience before. So we was just happy that we got through the Finger Lakes with all the vibes being good. And he said to me, you know, we're here to be the light for people. We got to keep showing the good. So I definitely was not living in the emptiness of form at that moment and with this man and at that winery. And I think we were all very aware of form then. Sometimes that awareness keeps us from really seeing each other. And sometimes exterior form is exquisitely honest and is the authentic expression, authentic experience. And here I have a poem from Emily Dickinson. And she says, I like a look of agony because I know it's true. Men do not sham convulsion nor simulate a throw. The eyes glaze once, and that is death. Impossible to feign the beads upon the forehead by homely anguish strung. Mm-hmm, right? Isn't she tough? I like a look of agony. But here, for her, is the most authentic self, right? The form stripped bare. It is the look of suffering, of physical pain, right before death, and it isn't pretty. It isn't simulated. It's the real thing. And Dickinson points to our constant covering up, our masking of ourselves, when she holds up agony as a kind of virtue, an honesty. And so I ask myself, how many are the ways in which I've masked myself? From small ways, maybe being kind when I actually was feeling a bit withholding. Was that a mask? I don't know. Or was it just striving to be better? I smile sometimes when I'm not feeling it. Maybe I can question the authenticity of that. Is it a problem? Sometimes when I'm mad about something, I'll say, I'm not mad about that because I'm not sure that my anger was okay. I'm not sure I'm justified. I'm a bit ashamed and I don't want to say it, right? I know what I want to be. I want to be a true adult, which is to be a bodhisattva. To be a bodhisattva is to be a complete adult, taking responsibility, realizing that we're all connected, being that, I was going to say that good. I'm not sure. But sometimes all I want to be is a child. When I was a child, all I wanted to be was an adult. I don't know if you had that kind of childhood where you're like, I can't wait to make my own decisions, get past all these adults who don't know what they're doing. Sometimes, it doesn't go quite that easily. I want to point to something that Zenju Earthlin Manuel wrote. When we're overwhelmed by pain and suffering or by groundlessness, we move to the next beyond. I was thinking about that beyond that comes at the end of the Heart Sutra, gate, gate, para, gate, parasamgate, that call to go beyond. And sometimes we don't understand what going beyond means. We think that it's not for us. We think you have to be in some special state or some special person to go beyond. But Zenshu reminds us that going beyond is just us in our most quaking moments, not in our heroic moments, not when we're staying on top of the hill and feeling, yes, good. It's when we're falling apart. There's our chance for going beyond. We've probably all had, or when one day we'll have, those moments of Emily Dickinson anguish. Nothing hidden, nothing held back, just complete openness. Complete presence, back to an infant state. When that has happened to me, I feel permeable. If someone were to touch me then, I'd feel like they would come all the way through, right to me, right inside. So sometimes form keeps us from seeing each other. Sometimes form is stripped bare to honesty. Sometimes being aware of our form and how it's perceived in the world is the most important thing we can use to keep us safe. So I've lived in a female form my whole life, and I'm very aware of the physical spaces I enter, how crowded it is, how lonely, how dark, how many paces is it to get to the light? Am I ready? Are my keys out? Who am I going out with? Who do I trust? Who has my back? How do I look to other people? How am I getting home? I and my sisters were raised in a particular way by an overprotective mother who believed that to be a woman was kind of a paradox. We were supposed to be smarter and stronger than any man, but we were not complete without a man. Our most important task was to be married, but never be dependent. We needed to find good husbands, but no man could be trusted. Makes a hard life. But I'm balancing it all. It used to be harder, now it's easier. Sometimes I think I balanced it. But in balancing, I let things go. So I have a female Sangha friend who spent months living in Harriman State Park, which is about an hour north of here, and it's like the real woods. So I think this is like crazy and brave and crazy and something I could never do, but I kind of wish I could do. I love hiking in Harriman State Park. In fact, it's probably my favorite place to hike because it's just like really wild and not very crowded and beautiful. And it's got bears. I don't want to see a bear. I'm not one of those people. I'm very aware of the bear situation. I respect bears and I don't want them near me. And I've seen evidence of bears multiple times at Harriman. In fact, I saw one not too far from me. Also, I think this was back in August as well. So my friend, of course, had a bear encounter and it was beautiful. It was a beautiful bear encounter. It was, they literally looked deep into each other's eyes. And I'm like, no, I have no desire for that kind of experience. I don't want to look deep into the bear's eyes. But I was also kind of jealous. I was like, wow, that's kind of really brave, right? Really brave. She slept on a hammock. It wasn't even inside a tent. But those are the choices that I balanced out of my life as a woman. I think as a woman, I define my life narrowly enough to take that possibility off the table. I tell myself, if I were a man, I would have kept that possibility on the table. Would I? Maybe. I don't know. Could I have seen my life through other lenses? Can I now? Maybe my life could be bigger in some ways that I just don't want to admit to. So there's a freedom in the making of that choice to go somewhere dangerous. I don't feel that freedom. I'm careful in the world. When I go hiking alone, and I do, I'm usually the only woman out alone, and I'm very aware of it. I'm aware of danger, whether I'm on a city street, in the woods, or in a winery upstate. I'm aware that I can be prey to another person or to an animal that's not a person. I'm aware that things may happen that I didn't expect, that I didn't prepare for. I try to keep the chances on my side. I try to expect the unexpected. I see no irony in that. I'm totally convinced that I am right. And I really want to be wrong. Being in this body, the deep body memories, these deep body memories are what the dancer, choreographer, and cultural icon Alvin Ailey called blood memories. He was able to capture the physical and the emotional, and I don't think I'm ever going to make a distinction anymore between the physical and the emotional. They just seem to be way too tied together. But he captured this in movement. He captured these experiences, these blood memories, and he transfigured them into joy and love and overcoming. And there's this wonderful exhibit at the Whitney called Edges of Ailey, which I would really recommend to anybody. You're going to get a wonderful, rich eyeful and soundful. So Alvin Ailey was called Earthman by another choreographer because he believed that our creative power came from the bottom of our feet, up from the earth and into our bodies. And that feels like kind of like right to me. Like when I heard that, I was like, I stopped. I put my feet on the ground. And I was like, yeah, I could feel that. And it makes me kind of want to stomp, right? And shake loose. And maybe shake loose all that careful balancing that I do. Again, Zenju Earthland says that we are tied not only to the elements of fire, water, earth, and air, but are free in space, time, and place. This earthy forminess gets me closer to formlessness. Living with formlessness, what the Dharma calls us to, living the reality of that as opposed to just a theory is difficult and simple. It doesn't require the kind of balancing act I feel like I'm always doing, the armor I sometimes wear, the strategies I'm creating. We see into the nature of our true universal selves. That doesn't sound difficult. It does. But Zazen is living true universal self. The Zen teacher again, Kosho Ukiyama, expressed it this way. We don't gradually become enlightened and eventually attain Buddhahood by means of Zazen. This small individual I, right, the small Shariputra, who believed in the primacy of the male body, that small individual I we talk of will always be deluded. But regardless of that, Zazen is Buddha. We take the Buddha's posture with the body of this deluded being and throw ourselves into it. And then he quotes Dogen Zenji. With one leap, we immediately enter Buddhahood. With one leap, Alvin Ailey shows us how to be formless, moving through form. So here's Leonard Cohen. Do I have any more quotes? Let me see. This might be my last. No, maybe not. Almost. Okay. Here's Leonard Cohen on something I think is similar, and it's about falling. He falls into the sky. He falls into the light. None can hurt him as he falls. Blessed are you, shield of the falling, wrapped in his fall, concealed within his fall. He finds the place he is gathered in. While his hair streams back and his clothes tear in the wind, he is held up, comforted. He enters into the place of his fall. Blessed are you, embrace of the falling, foundation of the light, master of the human accident. Rilke would add, give yourselves to the air, to what you cannot hold. So our bodies are the sutras, and there's a mystery in that. Our bodies are already balanced and perfect and living in the light, and there's faith in that. There's faith in that statement. We feel this in Zazen. As Ukiyama reminds us, we aim in the direction of Buddha in Zazen. Our whole lives are aiming in the direction of Buddha. When we take refuge in the specific sacred form of Zazen, which is happening not just when you're in the Zendo and not just when you're sitting in the Zazen mudra, it's happening every moment of our lives. And then when we let even attachment to the form fall away, we have the entirety of the world. On the days when I don't see this clearly, on the many days when I'm living in the small I with my body that sometimes I'm very proud of for no good reason, and sometimes I'm not very proud of for no good reason, on those days when I'm full of distinctions, and one minute I'm dwelling in heaven, and the next minute when I'm dwelling in hell, I can come back into the perfection, into Leonard Cohen's foundation of the light, by bowing. Right now, this body, today, I can do a full prostration. But I know that that won't always be the case. Right now, today, I can touch my forehead to the ground. And in that way, I let go of all boundaries, balancing acts, worries, small-minded me, the woman, the person, and then I touch the infinite, which is all of you and everyone else who's not here. It's the land of the Buddhas. And I bow to the Buddha, and I bow to all of you.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit our website at zmm.org/zcnyc.